Welcome to Warships Pod, and in this episode we're weighing up the Iran war and asking where we are today. Bearing in mind things change apparently at the whim of the President's Truth Social postings, in which he lambasts especially the UK for its poor naval response and not opening up air bases earlier as he sees it. That is, of course, the one and only President Trump of the USA. And yet, the UK is there in a defensive role, working up a mine clearance plan, whether thin or practical or not, we will find out or not sometime in the near future. It also has jets, ships, helicopters, sailors, soldiers, Royal Marines, aviators, and RAF personnel deployed, and is providing major support via air bases in the UK and Cyprus. And I should know, as for weeks now, where I live, you can hear the rumble of American bombers, B-1s and possibly B-52s in the skies, heading to and from Iran at certain times of the day, and allegedly refueling on the way out from KC-135 tankers. And indeed, it was my Sunday morning alarm call last weekend. And then 10 hours later, I heard the same rumble, which may have been them coming back, I don't know. Our guests this time on this episode are Gary Blackburn and James Botanis, both regular contributors to Warships High Fire magazine, and it's a real pleasure to have them back again.
Hi Ian, always a pleasure to be joining you for the Warships Pod and with Gary today as well.
Yeah, hi both. Hi James, hi Ian. Always a pleasure to contribute, and I don't know, every time I come on here I say we live in interesting times and think it can't get any more interesting, but it always does. So
yeah, it does.
Here we are again.
Yeah. So anyway, chaps, your concise overall view of this pot mess we're in with the Iran war. Can I ask you to just give us, in turn, an assessment? So start with you, Gary. Where do you think we are with this this event?
Well, I think what the Americans and the Israelis have sought to do is essentially a strategy of coercion. They've tried to use naval power and air power in order to... what this is, in order to effect regime change and to prevent the Iranians from having any kind of nuclear capability, and also to attrite its ballistic missile capability. I think the problem is that the strategy that ran parallel to that was this so-called decapitation strategy. And it almost feels as though that worked too well. And I'm going here solely off comments that the President of the United States has made when he said, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we seem to have killed everybody. Now, if that has actually happened, then it makes a strategy of coercion quite difficult, because who are you actually coercing? Who is left to coerce? So they seem to have kind of run out of road in that regard, and then are trying to kind of flip what the objectives actually are. So they're stepping away from regime change. Possibly that ship sailed in January, when obviously there was a major uprising of the civil population in Iran. And unfortunately, you know, many thousands of them were executed by the regime. Where I have some sympathy with critics of Trump's policy and the Israeli policy is that the phrase, it's very hard to effect regime change from the air, is true. So I think attempts at, and I think if you really want to end Iran's nuclear programs, then probably you do need to effect regime change. And therein lies the conundrum, because in order to do that with any kind of degree of confidence, you would need forces on the ground. And obviously, what we see with regards to American policy, and also I would argue British policy, is the effect of domestic politics on foreign policy and security policy. So as we know, a lot of the MAGA movement in America is dead set against boots on the ground, is instinctively isolationist, and Trump will be aware of that. So they've gone for this strategy of coercion because it's a hedge betting approach. But without the problem is it's almost kind of self-defeating unless you can actually affect events on the ground. Now they might again, who knows what's going to happen today, tomorrow, in the next week or so, they might again try and hedge their bets and go for some sort of campaign on the littoral, some kind of amphibious warfare around the key islands, which I guess we'll get onto in a second and talk about that. But that would just be moving up the escalatory ladder in terms of enhancing the coercion. That's not really going to change the regime per se. So this seemed to be a bit of conceptual confusion at the heart of the strategy. And I think that's why they're under a little bit of pressure, because what the Iranians have done, of course, is counter-coerce. You know, they've attacked the soft targets in the Gulf. I mean, the UAE has been the recipient, I think, of most of the missile strikes. And obviously that's put pressure on the Arab states, who then subsequently, presumably, I don't know for sure, but presumably behind closed doors are saying, we need to kind of bring this to a successful conclusion sooner rather than later. And then again, as I said, domestic politics, the clock is ticking. You've got your midterms coming up later in the year. I know we'll get onto this, I'm sure, but here in the UK, we've got some potentially very, very consequential local elections coming up on May the 7th. And I think that's actually driving a lot of UK policy as well. So James will know that in international relations theory, there is a subset of what we call realism, the neo-realist school, which argues very clearly that you've got your foreign policy and you've got your domestic policy, never the twain shall meet. Personally, I was never that persuaded by that, because I think democratically elected politicians are always subject to internal domestic pressures. So, but yeah, I think what we're seeing is Trump and the Americans trying to recast the objectives as they go along. So it's almost trying to say, well, we've got a win here because we've attracted a lot of their missile stocks, so we'll chalk that up as a win. But that's a long way from where they started at the beginning.
What about yourself, James? What's your opinion on it?
I fully agree with Gary. I think the United States, its actions are governed to a significant extent by the particular idiosyncrasies of Trump himself. And as Gary said, you really cannot separate here the domestic from the international. I think Trump was lured into thinking that tactical prowess, as seen, for example, in the Maduro raid, would automatically translate into achieving strategic ends. And they executed a plan without an overarching guiding strategy. They did not, in the White House and at the civilian side of the Pentagon, I think, identify what they really were seeking to do. Because talk of regime change or Iranian unconditional surrender. One, unconditional surrender. When has it previously been attained? Well, Second World War against Nazi Germany. You had to do an awful lot of legwork to get the Germans to unconditionally surrender. And in the end, it took them a week, even after their capital had fallen, their Führer had killed himself, and the country was split between the Allies and the Soviets. And then they finally got round to surrendering. So the idea that no matter how intense bombing raids could be launched on Iran, the suggestion that Iran would fold, ignoring, of course, the lessons of the Iran-Iraq war, where they took horrendous punishment over 8 years and they didn't surrender. You know, and failing to learn the lessons of Operation Iraqi Freedom, where you send 150,000 troops into a country one third the size of Iran and they weren't sufficient. You know, how many troops would you need to occupy even a substantial chunk of Iran and ensure that its nuclear program was effectively ended and its regime overthrown and replaced by someone else? A nonsensical approach to planning. Or, you know, Israeli suggestions about a fracturing of the country where you could exploit ethno-nationalist and sectarian fissures, say, for example, to carve off a Turkish region, a Kurdish region, or an Azeri region, or a Balochi region. Those suggestions, again, would have just brought in external intervention. But the last thing Turkey would want to see is the Kurds from Iraq moving in to link up with the Kurds in Iran. Conversely, the Turks might not have minded the Azeris breaking off and linking up with Azerbaijan to the north. Pakistanis, the last thing they would have wanted is an autonomous Balochi region in Iran emerging. So there just does not seem to have been any overarching strategic framework guiding US decision-making bar, well, we're going to blow a lot of stuff up and demand they surrender to us. And is it that within the Pentagon and the White House, they just think American power is so overwhelming that any country will immediately kowtow to them, regardless of that country's own interests or agency? Or is it just that the civilians in the Pentagon and the White House do not listen to what the military planners and diplomats in the State Department and CIA, etc., will be telling them? But I think, you know, Trump is right. This is going to be a major reshaping of the geopolitics of the region and beyond, but perhaps not in the way he intended.
Yeah, but turning it around to the key naval aspect, in fact, the key aspect of the whole thing, we have the Strait of Hormuz conundrum. And of course, people forget, maybe in the US administration, but not lots of other people, that the reason that there was no trouble, if you like, from Iran during Iraqi freedom and also during Desert Storm, the perfectly executed expulsion of Iraqi troops from Kuwait, was because Iran chose not to be involved and just sat there on the sidelines, and it suited Iran. And of course, during the tanker war in the 80s, it was the Iranians versus the Iraqis. So in a way, the casualties there, which were included two US Navy frigates and also numerous merchant vessels, either damaged and I think one or two sunk, a few sunk over a period of years, were kind of incidental to what was happening amid the massive slaughter on land. So it seems to have come as a great shock to the American administration that they, they found themselves in a pickle over the Strait of Hormuz, and now the reaction seems to be that the problem should be somebody else's to clear up. So, I mean, what's your point of view of the failure to anticipate that Hormuz would become the pivotal battle? So, do you want to go first, Gary?
Absolutely baffling, because this must have been wargamed 1,000 times. So that has been the most surprising aspect of the whole thing, really. I mean, just to segue slightly, we've talked about American policy, but from an Israeli perspective, I think this is slightly different. I think, you know, we use that phrase, the war of choice, an awful lot, and I think it's not quite as binary as the term is meant to suggest, to be honest, but with America, it feels very much like a war of choice, which has gone slightly awry. I think from the Israeli perspective, it probably feels more like a war of necessity. Obviously, they're ringed by lots of Iranian proxies. There was the 12-day conflict last year, and Iran is relatively weak. So they're probably thinking, if not now, then when? And so, of course, that narrative plays into a kind of long-standing narrative that Israel has far too much influence in Washington. And I think that's commonly held view across the political spectrum, but there'll probably be plenty of people on the right, and particularly in the MAGA movement, who take that view. So that's going to be amplified to the nth degree. But back to the actual kind of the military strategy in terms of trying to achieve these ends that we've talked about. I think if I were to do this, and I've not wargamed it myself, but if this is really an exercise in coercion and naval coercion primarily, then there's not enough assets in the region to actually undertake that strategy. So it's half cooked. You would have to move in, you know, I mean, the Americans have the capability. They've got the US Marine Corps. And even now there's talk of, they're sending in some Marine Expeditionary Units. The elements of the 82nd Airborne are on standby. Talk of taking islands such as Karg Island. It all kind of makes sense. It still doesn't feel as though they have enough forces in theater to really do it. And really, if you wanted to do it, you'd have to probably take the littoral. So you'd have to seize the coastline of Iran in order to do it, which would be a massive undertaking. I mean, if anyone can do it, it's the Americans. But again, I think this half-in, half-out strategy, hybrid strategy, you know, there was an element of this in 2003, even though that was much more significant and more. That was a strategy of control, so they were taking over the whole country. But even then, you'll recall Rumsfeld got into a bit of bother because he thought he could do it with a lighter footprint than was actually what was required, and a lighter footprint than Desert Storm. So I don't know. I think James makes a good point. Has something got lost in translation between the Pentagon and the White House, or I don't know. But again, I mean, we'll talk about the UK, but something similar seems to have happened on a much smaller scale as regards to the what we'd call the strategy bridge, that interface between the politicians and the military. Do I think it's, where would we go from here? Again, I think if it were me, you would have to put a lot more assets in the region, all of which says to me that they're looking for an off-ramp. The fact that J.D. Vance has supposedly gone to Pakistan, J.D. Vance, of course, is the most isolationist of the senior politicians in America. I mean, there's been a lot of banter on X about, you know, Marco Rubio's having a great few months and therefore he's going to become the MAGA pick after Trump's gone. But I suspect in the long run, J.D. Vance will be the main winner because he's actually been more prudent. And it says to me that they're not prepared to actually, they're bluffing. Sorry, so it sounds terrible for me to say that, I think, in a way, but it feels like they're bluffing. Maybe they'll seize one or two small islands and declare victory. But it definitely feels like they're looking for an off-ramp. And if they were going to do it, they could do it, but they'd have to really go all in to do it. And it just doesn't feel like politically that's on the agenda, to be honest.
And James, what do you think? Because I'd be interested to hear your opinion on the island seizing idea as part of an attempt to force a way through the Strait of Hormuz, get the oil and gas flowing again. But also, as you've written about in the next edition of the magazine, the May edition, the Iranians have a formidable array of weaponry to actually frustrate such a thing and make it a hell on water and on earth. What do you think?
Yeah, I fully agree with Gary, but Varant, the assets in place. I mean, if you were going to try to secure the islands in the Strait of Hormuz, let alone actually try to seize the southern Iranian coastline, one, you're going to need a hell of a lot more forces, both Marines at sea and forces ideally deployed in the United Arab Emirates as jumping off points. You would also need really the buy-in of the United Arab Emirates, one, for offensive operations from their territory, and two, allied support in terms of the UAE providing naval and air support for ops in the area. In terms of actually seizing islands, yes, the US can obviously do it. Although, you know, the last time they actually looked at large-scale amphibious landings was back in 1991 for Desert Storm, where they had the Marine Expeditionary Force at sea with, if I remember correctly, 13,000 Marines. That was, of course, simply for demonstration. It was poising to fix the Republican Guard in place, thinking we've got to face a seaborne invasion whilst the Americans actually swung in from the west. In terms of the last time the US actually carried out a large-scale opposed landing, you're probably looking back to Grenada. And of course, the whole point of latest US Marines approach to amphibious operations or littoral maneuver is that you use the maneuver space the sea confers to take the enemy by surprise, telegraphing that you're going to take these islands or this part of the coastline. And if you're going to free the Strait of Hormuz, you know, the Iranians have a pretty good idea of the sort of area you're going to be landing in. So it sort of negates the whole advantage of maritime power projection, unless you want to go for the large-scale opposed landing into an area where the enemy has favourable geography. The Iranian coastline isn't exactly nice sandy beaches. You've got the topography of the region favours defence. They've got small boats, coastal defence missile systems, anti-ship ballistic missiles, anti-ship cruise missiles, unmanned surface vessels, you know, speedboats essentially packed full of explosives that the Houthis have used, the Ukrainians have used to great effect in the Black Sea, coastal artillery, all this sort of thing, first-person view drones, so essentially a flying IED, as well as, of course, all your traditional blokes with rifles that would be in, say, the Iranian coastal city of Bandar Abbas, which you would be probably wanting to take if you were looking to secure the Strait of Hormuz. That's the major coastal city in that part of Iran's coastline. And, you know, we can just go back to the Iraq War and look at, for example, the scale of effort it took for US Marines to secure Fallujah in the first battle of Fallujah against the insurgents there. That, though, was within the context of Fallujah being a city in the desert surrounded by a country that the United States was occupying, not actually trying to put a force in to a hostile territory and then trying to take a city and then hold it. I can't imagine Trump would want, ahead of midterm elections, for there to be large-scale US air land operations in Iran carried out by the Marines conducting landings from the sea, or US forces moving from the Gulf states via the air into southern Iran. Because no matter how tactically proficient the United States Marine Corps is, how its 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne, etc., how good they are, they will inexorably suffer losses, and they could be quite severe losses if you're going into southern Iran. And I can't see that being politically acceptable either to the American people in general or to the MAGA base in particular. And it raises the other question. So you've secured the Strait of Hormuz for now. Well, how long are you going to hold it for? You hold it for 6 months, while the Iranians, like the Taliban in 2001, they could just say, we'll be patient. If we got to wait 20 years, we'll wait 20 years and then we'll come back. And even if you do seize control of the Strait of Hormuz, what's stopping Iran from launching one-way attack drones and ballistic missiles or cruise missiles from other locations within the country to hit an oil tanker alongside at a refinery in Saudi Arabia or Qatar? You know, you'll still undermine confidence in using the Persian Gulf's oil and gas resources and maritime communications in the region by targeting ships east or west of the Strait of Hormuz. So you've really got to either go very big and squash the Iranian threat completely, which probably not feasible in political terms or military terms, or create some sort of political settlement. And that raises a whole host of unpalatable questions, both in terms of the US position in the region and more broadly.
And about the wider implications, for example, to do with NATO and what the future of NATO might be, on top of, you know, the Middle East itself. Gary, do you think what we're seeing now is a real move towards the Americans getting out of NATO, inverted commas, the end of NATO? Do you think that's on the horizon?
Possibly. I think, I mean, the current crisis is huge. It's hard to overstate, so we could all be queuing up for petrol in a month's time. I mean, this is, and people have made comparisons with 1973 and the Arab-Israeli war. But I think even bigger than all of that is the pressure on the Western alliance, and in particular Anglo-American relations, because Anglo-American relations is the glue of the Western alliance. And there've been some alarming reports in the media yesterday about how, not just at the highest level, there's extreme friction, but that's starting to trickle down into the kind of the more operational level. It's becoming, I think the phrase that was used for the Americans to get permission to fly their sorties from Fairford and Diego Garcia is becoming stickier, was the language that was used. Equally, British insight into what's going on in the Oval Office is becoming less and less capable. You know, there's kind of an arm's length relationship developing. That's deeply alarming. I say it's alarming because we all know that NATO is more than just the United States, but its combat potential is really 80% American, 20% the rest. And we've long argued, all of us, of course, that we should be, as the Americans have said for many years, going back to at least to Obama, that the Europeans need to be doing more for their own defense. But to be fair, in some parts of Europe, they're acting like rational actors. They're looking at the increased threat. Poland, Germany, Scandinavian states, etc., they're actually acting rationally and they're rearming. but still we find ourselves in this slightly absurd position with regard to the defense investment program, of that not being signed off by the Treasury. And so you have Whitehall at war with itself over that at the least propitious moment in my lifetime. I can't remember a situation quite like this. So I think for NATO, yes, we've already seen, I think, correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Americans have stepped back from some of the command structures within NATO, sending a really strong signal that they're deprioritizing it. And I think it's kind of tragic that the Anglo-American relationship is on the rocks right at this moment in time. I mean, I don't want to get too domestic, focus too much on the domestic politics, but a few weeks ago, the government nearly fell because of the Mandelson affair, and it might still fall because of that. I worry now that if we don't have access to the presidency, we don't have influence. If we don't have influence, he said today, I think, that he's thinking about winding NATO down. Now, constitutionally, there are limits on what he can and can't do. I don't think he's got the constitutional powers in the United States just to withdraw. But, you know, if the relationship is being undermined at that operational level, then you can say that de facto, if not in legal terms, NATO is a dead duck. And therefore, you look at something like the Defense Investment Program and the desperate attempts by many sensible people in the UK to try and fast forward the pathway to 3% of GDP to get it to be 2029 rather than 2035. And you just wonder where on earth, even 3%, without the Americans and NATO, 3%, 3.5% just seems like fantasy strategy to me. When we often, you know, those of us who are kind of keen on having the UK as being as powerful as realistically possible, often get brickbats thrown at us as kind of like, you know, fantasy fleets and tropes like that. But it seems to me that our opponents in this debate themselves are full of fantasy strategy, because they imagine that there are no threats, and they imagine that, I mean, that, you know, we see it in the commentary all the time, or we can ride out Trump. Well, you might be able to ride out Trump, but it's far from clear to me you'll be able to ride out J.D. Vance, who's far less, far more calculating. Trump has an emotional, I mean, James touched on it earlier. He's a bit of a loose cannon, to put it mildly, right? So he shoots from the hip. J.D. Vance seems like a much more measured individual to me. And I think I wouldn't bet against the Republicans winning the next two presidential elections. And therefore, what is Whitehall going to do about that? And that takes us inexorably to how defense policy is put together in the United Kingdom and how systemically flawed it is. And we might want to get into this as we go on. But, you know, defense policy in the UK, naval policy in the UK, is a subset of policy per se. In fancy academic language, it's an epiphenomenon. It's a subset, basically. So if there are problems at the higher levels of policy and the body politic, inevitably they'll filter down to UK defence policy and UK naval policy. So everything we're seeing in terms of dysfunction is really a byproduct of that. And, you know, Professor John Bew, of King's College London, James's alma mater, and an advisor to four prime ministers, including the current one, has said some interesting things in the last few weeks about this being an inflection point in our history, and how we need a new kind of, I'd call it, you know, you could call it a grand strategy. We need to look afresh at political economy. We need to look afresh at how the state's put together. Because quite clearly, you know, it's not working at the minute, particularly in relation to defence and security. And if NATO is going to be a de facto dead duck, that work has to be done now. We can't, even the dip, as inadequate as it is, it hasn't been signed off yet. So it's pure dysfunction, Ian. It gives me no pleasure to say any of this whatsoever, because I find it all very worrying. I actually think this is the biggest story. And there's only one positive thing that's come out of all this crisis, which is that now the general public can see just how dire things have become. And it's crossed from our world into the mainstream world, particularly the Navy. And obviously we're all navalists, so it's kind of a, it's a double-edged thing, because we don't want the Navy to be getting battered rhetorically in the media. But if that's what's required in order to for action to take place, then it might be worth it in the long run. So yeah, so that's my views on that.
So James, when it comes to the UK's guiding grand strategic assumptions since maybe even the Second World War, I mean, do you think they are they've been flawed all along? I mean, like Gary says, it's now being exposed decades later that that they were wrong, and we're now being you know, caught totally vulnerable in a cruel new age.
Yep, absolutely. The guiding assumptions since effectively the end of the Second World War has been that the United States is, one, the guarantor of the rules-based international order. It's the guarantor of the global economic and financial systems. Trump, with his return to tariffs, protectionism, etc., last year, smashed that international economic and financial order. In security terms, the basis for British thinking since World War II has been that the United States is the ultimate guarantor of global security, whether that was providing the bulwark against the Soviets in the Cold War, or through the unipolar moment in the immediate post-Cold War world, or leading the global war on terror after 9/11. And of course, through NATO, the key point of NATO was to keep the Americans in Europe and arguably, you know, keep the Germans down and the Russians out. Now, the policy of the Trump administration seems to be, well, we don't perhaps think too much about the Germans, but we really would like the Russians, certainly into as much of Ukraine as they would like, which of course poses a distinct threat to NATO. And if the Russians want to look at security arrangements governing Eastern Europe, then we're open to do that. And the United States, well, we don't really want to be part of European security anymore. We would much rather perhaps focus on our own hemisphere, which we've asserted dominance over through this absolute corruption of the Monroe Doctrine, the so-called Donroe Doctrine. But for the UK, you know, this is, you know, Corelli Barnett in his excellent volume, The Collapse of British Power, wrote that in May 1940, Britain faced a crisis of grand strategy, because all the assumptions for how a new war with Germany would be fought were based on the idea that it would go pretty much like the First World War. France would hold the line. Britain would focus on air and maritime power. The French would control the Mediterranean whilst we did other things. Of course, enabling as well the deployment of naval assets out to defend the empire in East Asia. And of course, May, June 1940, that all collapses. And I would argue we are facing a similar situation now. I believe NATO is functionally brain dead. It is a patient in an intensive care ward. They are on life support. They are brain dead. No one's had the guts to pull the plug, though. If Putin decided to try to threaten somewhere in Eastern Europe, I can't imagine Trump actually authorizing US armed forces to respond to that. I think he would probably put out a Truth Social post saying, look, I don't care about some village in the corner of Poland or whatever. Come on, Europe, do a deal with Putin. I've been trying to enter the war in Ukraine for, but was not my war in the first place. It was Biden's war. It's time to do a deal, and we'll flog you weapons at a markup. But, you know, I'm not going to send American soldiers to die over some corner of Eastern Europe. But it goes beyond NATO, because if you're the South Koreans, the Japanese, the Australians, any country that has an alliance with the United States, one, you're either already getting hammered by Trump's tariff policies, and two, if the United States can treat its oldest, most important alliance, NATO, the way it's doing, how can you be sure that if your policymakers in Seoul, North Korea decides to shell Yongpyong Island again, as it did in 2010, can you be sure that Trump would actually fulfill the US-Korean alliance obligations? Or would he, especially given that North Korea can threaten US cities with nuclear warheads on ICBMs, would he look to do a deal with Kim Jong-un? So all the assumptions about we can focus on welfare, we can maintain armed forces at a certain level, a certain proportion of GDP, I would argue they've all been blown out of the water now. We need to think very much in what does the UK need to do to defend its interests? Who do we need to work with? European allies, allies in East Asia, the Middle East. But then we've got to identify what those interests are. You know, where are the key areas for Britain economically in terms of raw materials that we need for the economy? All those factors then determine what armed forces do we need to defend those interests and contribute to our allies in the most effective and efficient way. Yes, it will involve questions over how much of GDP to spend on defence. And as Gary said, you know, 3% now is just fantasy. We were spending 4% of GDP at the end of the Cold War, but then we had Ronald Reagan in the White House, or George Bush Sr., and US military power. How much do we need to spend realistically now? 5%? Probably not. 8%? 10%? Yeah, these are very, very tough questions. And we're just fortunate that it's happening in the Middle East and the United States is doing all this whilst the UK itself is not actually under fire, because we could have got into this situation of finding out our grand strategic assumptions were deeply flawed in a sharper, more painful way.
Gary, I know you probably want to come in on the grand strategic assumptions. I'm imagining it's something you can get your teeth into. But if we could spin it round to talk about it within the context of the Royal Navy, that'd be good. Because we're a naval podcast. but the thing that occurs to me is I interviewed a very senior naval officer. In fact, he became First Sea Lord in the early 2000s, back then. And he set out for me, you know, the evolving Royal Navy, the carriers were coming, etc. But then at that time, the Royal Navy was adequate for a medium-sized naval power with global interests and, you know, all the trade to protect, etc. And it seems to me that we'd be lucky if we had anywhere near that today, when in fact we don't. So, I mean, you know, what is the state of the RN and how can it deliver on any kind of grand strategy, Gary? Has it got a chance?
I mean, yeah. I mean, to be slightly more optimistic, I mean, there are, what, seven escort vessels in build as we speak. Three are fitting out. You then get into the nitty-gritty of, well, how is that being financed? Now, if we were to have a mindset of urgent operational requirements, we might find that the way, necessity being the mother of invention, to get those vessels into commission far quicker than is currently the case. So, you know, so in order to improve our maritime strategy, and that's our USP, right? That's our national USP. We're an island, and because we're an island, everything we do is by definition expeditionary or maritime, pretty much 99% of it. So it goes to James's point, what would we do? How would we recalibrate? You know, what's our interest look like now? I think there's two ways of looking at it. If we imagine a world in which the United States is still our primary ally, and that you know, Donald Trump, the king's going to see Donald Trump, is it in a month or so? He may flip. He flips all the time, right? And think all this might die down. In which case, you know, it's about, well, what do we bring to the collective Western alliance? I think being that bridge between the United States and Europe is still, and Asia for that matter, is still a really important role that we could actually play. We've decided to put that, we've forfeited that role. I mean, so for this particular crisis, I think we took a very legalistic view in the first 2 days of the conflict, which I think, I mean, you could take a realist view, which is that this is now a conflict, we shouldn't get involved in it, it's not in the national interest. I think I agree with that. That's not the view we actually articulated. The view we articulated was that this is in breach of international law. In my opinion, I'm not an expert in international law, but I know enough to say that's both right and that's both wrong. The point being, international law is entirely in the eye of the beholder, inherently subjective, and you can frame it to kind of back up whatever political decision you've made. But if America's still in the game, if America still wants to be part of the Western alliance, then that's one element. If it isn't, then, you know, Mark Carney, give us a kind of grand strategic vision of what the world might look like, where you have lots of middle-sized powers who might club together. So NATO 2.0, obviously potential allies in East Asia as well, Japan, South Korea, like-minded states. And, you know, these are serious countries with serious latent power capabilities. The Royal Navy, to me, is kind of whatever grand strategy you push towards, the Royal Navy is the key, because of the island nature of where we live, the archipelago nature. It's Colin Gray, the late Professor Colin Gray, said everything we do by default is expeditionary or maritime. So that being the case, what's the state of the Navy? Well, you know, it's obviously not great. We can see a future where the escort vessel numbers recover. Some of the things that have been said about the non-appearance of the dip are quite alarming, particularly the current context. The Type 83 is being called into question, which is just madness in the current context. If you look at the missile threat, why on earth would you think, oh, well, then we'll get rid of the Type 83? That's clearly bonkers. But if you've got a different financial envelope, you can have a different level of ambition. And it's not even ambition, it's just doing what's absolutely necessary. And for the Navy, you know, we all know that I think achieving what's in the SDR is one good step that we should be looking at for the Navy. But as with all the other services, we need more mass as well. And things, you know, drones and unmanned systems have come of age. And they can help us provide that mass. I mean, I watched an interview with Al Carnes recently, potentially touted as another Labour leader and therefore Prime Minister, on the subject of drones. And he was quite interesting in terms of the experiences of Ukraine and Russia and how you can bring those to the party to achieve mass with limited resources. So that's the kind of thing I think we need to be looking at in terms of our sort of technical capabilities. But I think for Britain, it really is always going to be that the Navy has to be in the forefront of any grand strategy by default. If we were German or Polish, I wouldn't be saying that. You know, saying it's all about the army and we can have a little bit of a Navy as an enabler. And for air power, it's all about the land of the sea fundamentally. And that's just geography. And air power is the enabler of both those domains. So I'm trying to be slightly optimistic here. There are a lot of warships in build. But then we go back to the Treasury and how it funds it and the self-defeating nature of that. And there's a lot of analysis out there. I think some of it's even the Treasury's own analysis, which shows that by pushing things to the right and delaying, you add 25% costs on a warship. That's crackers. There's no defending that, okay? So we say, oh, well, defense procurement's terrible. And it is, and there are many negative, nefarious effects of that. That's their symptoms of systemic failure. And at the heart of that failure, and this is what Bew's talking about, John Bew, is how these things are financed. And they don't do it like that in France, for example. And the French get a lot more bang for their euros. So, and that's the other thing. One final point. As I've said before, what we're seeing playing out in real time is the interconnection of navies and economies. I mean, you know, the Red Sea crisis, the Strait of Hormuz crisis, the corresponding effect on global growth. This is all the sort of thing that Paul Kennedy wrote about, you know, 40, 50 years ago. It's just amazing how little of this has seeped into what's known as the Treasury brain. But it's not just the Treasury, to be fair. It's just Whitehall and around. There are a few noble exceptions, but you can probably count them on one hand. Sorry, there you go.
So, James, the state of the RN, what's your take on that? And I mean, in light of the paralysis following the Strategic Defence Review, the SDR, and the Defence Investment Plan, the DIP, I mean, where are we with the Royal Navy? I mean, it's been exposed as fragile So what's your take on where we are with the Britain's fleet?
Yeah, fully agree with Gary. You know, there are perhaps some reasons to be optimistic. We got the Type 26 on the way, we got a Type 31 on the way. SSN AUKUS is at least starting to be developed as the thinking about the hybrid Navy, which is great stuff. I'm a little concerned that, you know, there's a lot of optimism about higher end uncrewed manned unmanned teaming. You know, they may not be as realizable in the near term as perhaps some estimates suggest, but it's great that work is underway. The problem is, you know, yes, there's good stuff coming tomorrow, but we are in the midst of crisis today. And because of the glacial pace at which it's taken to develop a replacement for the Type 23 frigate, if I remember correctly, the Future Surface Combatant Studies started in 1998, possibly even earlier than that. You know, the fact that it's nearly 30 years for us to get a new frigate in the water. I mean, we should not be competing with Moscow for who can take longest to get a new frigate in the water, nor about putting long-range missiles on the decks of aircraft carriers. But because of these decisions driven by the Treasury, we are now in the position where our operational choices are not perhaps where they need to be in relation to events today. And the Navy's credibility is perhaps suffering in the public's eyes and politicians' eyes, because can the First Sea Lord go to the Prime Minister, well, yes, I can give you these options. Ideally, I would like to be able to offer you that, but I can't offer you that option because this is not ready, this is gapped. And, you know, for the politicians, if they don't see a particular military capability as usable when they need it, is that going to be reflected in the next decision by the Treasury? And I don't want to get into a discussion of inter-service rivalry, but I expect there will also be a lot of inter-service tensions when you have a tight budgetary environment. But I thought the point that Gary made about the connection between economies and navies is brilliant, and it is fundamental. And Geoffrey Till, in his new edition of Sea Power, Geoff Till, one of the leading minds on all things maritime strategy and sea power, he has a chapter on navies and economies, and he starts with an anonymous quote that I think sums it up brilliantly. Navies win battles, economies win wars. And that is the problem that we have now. You know, we have a peacetime mentality in Whitehall, particularly within the Treasury, and the world has turned into a very dangerous, unstable place where assumptions made in peacetime or in better days are proving to be flawed, and the strategic environment is going to be forcing very difficult decisions. And, you know, we are an island. We have a historical legacy of maritime strategic credibility and a long history of maritime strategic thought. You know, we can go back to the days of Sir Julian Corbett 100 years ago. And we need to be translating that huge body of thought that is well known within academia in this country and within the services, but the whole continental versus maritime debate. We need to be getting that to policymakers and to make the point that it's not a question of, well, the Royal Navy should be this big and the other services take a back step. It's this fundamental point that we are an island. We are dependent on the sea for our economic well-being. And the Royal Navy doesn't just provide power at sea or from the sea. It's that enabling capability for the Army and the Royal Air Force to be able to do their jobs as well. Because unless we're having to fight on our own soil, we are inherently going to be doing something expeditionary, which requires moving by sea. 90% of the Army's stuff that was used for Optelic in 2003 it got there by sea. And any operation, whether it's in defence or NATO, a Middle East ally, whatever, it's going to be enabled by the sea. And we need to be able to do that whole enabling by sea task, because otherwise we are in deep trouble.
Yeah, no, totally agree with everything James has just said there. I think one final thought would be the RN is in a parlous state materially, but I think the point James made there about really about sea blindness is a really important one, because actually it's not obvious to me that we understand the strategic value of navies, which is incredibly broad. And Macron made us look really foolish when he sent his Charles de Gaulle-led flotilla into the Eastern Mediterranean in a demonstration of naval presence and poise. We could have done that. We actually could have done that. You know, if we're actually, if you know, there's a chap on X, I'm sure we all follow. He keeps putting his spreadsheet up, which shows the status of the Royal Navy major combatants at the minute. And there are three Type 45s, which are, you know, Dragons obviously deployed. There are two others, which are quite close to readiness if required in an emergency. This is an emergency. Now, you can take the view that we don't want to get directly involved, but we are kind of directly involved because events have sucked us in, hence why Dragon is off the coast of Cyprus now, hence why, you know, the RAF, the fleet they're on, the RAF regiment, they're all engaged. They're all shooting things down as we speak. And, you know, that I think we suffered a huge, huge hit in terms of reputational damage there, and I could not wrap my head around that one at all. And I don't think anybody else could either, to be honest. So it's all a bit after the Lord Mayor's show. And that says to me two things. One, we don't really understand sea power at the highest levels. Secondly, the naval voice is kind of not heard sufficiently. And I think also, whilst the navies are actually intrinsic, not only in terms of supporting economy and physical security, but also upholding the rules-based order, if you take a hyper-legalistic view of international relations, you're not going to use the navy because you effectively deter yourself. You become de-bellicized. And so you fret at the thought of the symbolism of sending HMS Prince of Wales to the Eastern Mediterranean or the Gulf of Oman. That's, I don't see how you reconcile that with the national interest, because this is going to sound a little bit grubby, but as sure as night follows day, Emmanuel Macron will monetize that expedition. In that part of the world, relationships matter tremendously. And when it kicks off, you have to be there. Even if you don't actually do an awful lot in a material sense, the fact that you showed the flag and you turned up counts an awful lot. And I just don't think the people making decisions at the highest level get that in the UK. And I think that's tragic, actually.
Well, I'd like to wrap up the podcast chat with something that's a favourite story of mine, which is that during Convoy HX-231, the legendary Royal Navy escort group captain, Peter Gretton, was preparing his ships for the fight ahead with the various U-boats gathering around the convoy. And he sent a light signal to the escorts, and it consisted of one word, and the word was anticipate. And I think that's what was completely missing from what the government did, whether you want to become involved or stand back, was they did not anticipate. And so that's a story from how we won the Battle of the Atlantic. I think that maybe, who knows, politicians might even like to hoist on board and follow. But anyway, that was my digression at the end. But thanks for coming on, chaps. And brilliant to have you giving us your insights.
Always a pleasure.
My pleasure, Ian.
Thanks for listening to Warships Pod. And I'd just like to mention that the next edition of the magazine, the May 2026 mag, features articles, commentaries, photography, and a lot else beside on the Iran war, and particularly on the struggle for Hormuz, the UK sending HMS Dragon to the Eastern Med, and also a look at, you know, is Britain still a sea power? So various elements of interest there in that edition. Also, other features include the Turkish task group that's deployed to northern waters and Royal Marines in the Arctic. So it's another packed edition for you to get your teeth into. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at WarshipsIFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at WarshipsIFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.